Welcome to the Science Podcast for June 21st, 2013. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This week, a new brain database, the fate of research powerhouses in the United States, and Bohr's atomic theory turns 100.
There wouldn't be any lasers, semiconductors, and the devices that follow from that, like computers and mobile phones, without the revolutionary idea of Niels Bohr.
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org. This podcast is also sponsored by Audible.com, home to over 100,000 audiobooks.
The human brain can be mapped in many different ways. You can have an atlas that lays out the composition by types of cells, neurons and supporting cells, gray matter versus white matter, or you can adopt a more topological approach, tracing the folds created from sulci and gyri on the bumpy surface of the brain. Alternatively, you can analyze the brain as traffic map, dense networks of fibers routing traffic of thought, emotion, and action. I spoke with Katrina Muntz about a different kind of map created using MRI and thinly sliced sections of the brain that captures these alternative views at ultra-high resolution.
Well, the big brain represents a digital 3D reconstruction of a human brain with a spatial resolution of 20 microns, which is smaller than the size of the human hair, exceeding those of existing reference brain by a factor of 50 in each dimension. So the big brain is based on histological sections which were stained for cell bodies and then reconstructed as a 3D volume.
The brain is architected at many levels. Can you describe some of the complexity that you're dealing with here?
The brain is indeed one of the most complex and most fascinating organs for any researchers, and it is organized on many levels or scales, as we say, including molecules, genes, neurons and their circuitry, but also long-distance fiber tracks with a length of up to several centimeters, brain areas, functional systems involved in cognition, language, emotional processing, or behavior. To illustrate this complexity, the brain has approximately 86 billion nerve cells, the same number of glial cells, and each of the nerve cells has approximately 10,000 synapses, that is, contact to other neurons. Mm-hmm.
That's a big problem to solve. Can you describe some of the challenges that have come about when you're trying to record and display this type of information, the complexity of the brain?
Well, I see two major challenges in the project. The first was to histologically process a human postmortem brain with a size of approximately 15 by 20 by 10 centimeter, and which has a highly folded surface, while each section is, in fact, only 0.02 millimeter thick. There are only a few labs in the world which are capable to do it. So the second challenge is to digitally reconstruct all these images, to process and to visualize the data with an original of 1 terabyte data size. So this is, again, a challenging effort.
Can you walk us through that process, the creation of the big brain, the sectioning of the brain, and then the digitization?
Well, the process consists of several steps. First, the brain was scanned using a magnetic resonance scanner, then embedded into paraffin, and then cut with a microtome for large sections into more than 7,400 sections. While doing this cutting, we took an image from every block face of the paraffin-embedded brain to have an undistorted reference. All these sections were then sampled, mounted on glass slides, and stained for cell bodies. All stained sections were then scanned with a flatbed scanner, and we used then these images of the histological sections to digitally remove artifacts which were introduced during the histological processing. Finally, the sections were aligned using section-to-section registration and using the MR image and the block face images as undistorted references. And these calculations were performed on high-performance facilities within the Compute Canada network. They are very intensive, time-intensive, and labor-intensive.
Because you have 7,000 slices, and each one has a profile, and they all need to be aligned and corrected?
Yes, that's true. And the problem is that every of these 7,400 sections is distorted a little bit different as compared to the neighboring section. So this makes it so challenging to reconstruct. these histological sections and to align it to neighboring sections. And the distortions are quite large, so they are in the range of 1 to 2 centimeters sometimes.
That's much bigger than the resolution that you're looking at.
Oh, yes. So this is really pushing the limits of 3D reconstruction, yeah.
Hmm. Can you talk about some of the notable differences between the information that your new high-res brain has to offer and past models?
Well, past models are based on magnetic resonance imaging, and this means that they have a resolution in the range of about 1 millimeter and a little bit above for functional imaging. Mm-hmm. That means this resolution is well above the cellular scale, but in the past it has been sufficient for establishing human brain atlases to capture on the level of information of cortical areas or subcortical nuclei, gyri, and sulci. Existing human brain atlases do not allow for an integration of information at the level of cortical layers, columns, microcircuits, cells, or so on. Such fine-grained anatomical resolution is a prerequisite to fully understand the interplay between architecture, brain structure on the one hand, and cognition, language, emotion, and other processes on the other hand. And we need such a high-resolution brain to bridge the gap between large-scale neural networks on the one hand and local circuitry on the other hand.
What about differences between individual brains? Not everybody has the same cells in the same arrangement. How are those differences reflected in this model?
Human brains indeed show a large intersubject variability, and this variability is much higher than variability, for instance, between mouse brains. So in order to address this question, we have linked the big brain model to existing atlases by calculating a transformation between our big brain and existing atlases. That is, we can apply the information about intersubject variability of areas, nuclei, functional activations, or brain shape, which is included in those atlases. But in the future, of course, we will process other big brains in order to address intersubject variability at the microstructural level as well.
Now that this brain is created and it's a freely available resource online, what kind of questions can researchers or anybody actually ask by probing the model?
Well, the big brain represents, first of all, a new reference brain, moving from a macroanatomical perspective in the range of centimeters or millimeters to a microscopic one on the level of cells or nearly cellular resolution. But that means that we can address now positions at the level of cortical layers and sublayers, not only at the level of cortical areas and nuclei. And we can now provide a frame for localizing findings from cellular neuroscience and mapping studies targeting receptor distribution, for instance, or small fiber bundles, gene expression data, and so on this microstructural level. Secondly, I see that researchers, and including me, we can analyze now parameters of the brain on a microscopical scale and in 3D. We can analyze, for instance, the cortical thickness and obtain measures of cortical thickness for each cortical area. This is important because cortical thickness changes during lifespan and in neurodegenerative disorders in particular, mm-hmm. and to have gold standards, robust and reliable parameters indicating how thick the cortex is indeed, is relevant for such studies. So finally, the big brain can be used to generate realistic input parameters for brain modeling and simulation. And as you are aware, there are many initiatives in the world now who try to simulate parts of the human brain or even the whole human brain. In addition, the big brain will push methodical development in image analysis tools for visualization, for interactive exploring such large data sets, and thus also push the limits for high-performance computing of such data sets.
Great. Catherine Amunz, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you for this interview.
Catherine Amunz and colleagues write about a high-resolution, interactive 3D map of the human brain in this week's Science.
Hey, podcast listeners, this week's show is sponsored by Audible, and right now they're offering a special deal. If you go to audiblepodcast.com/sciencemag, you can get a free audiobook of your choice.
And if you're looking for any ideas, I can recommend a new addition to the Audible collection. The Bonobo and the Atheist by Franz de Waal. De Waal was a contributor to our special issue on human conflict, and in this book, he writes about morality among primates.
One of his favorite research subjects. So check out that book and more from Audible, and don't forget, you can get a free download just for signing up at audiblepodcast.com/sciencemag. By the early 20th century, scientists knew that atoms existed. But in their minds, each atom was plum pudding, a nucleus at the center of an electron-studded cloud. Only with the publication of a seminal paper in the early 1900s did physicists become aware of electron energy states and their transitions between them via the absorption or emission of light. That seminal paper was Niels Bohr's atomic theory published 100 years ago. David Clary spoke with me about just how revolutionary this paper was at the time.
Before Niels Bohr, people had the idea of atoms that were very small particles that are very hard to break up, but they didn't know what those atoms looked like. And the model that's kind of been proposed around the time of Niels Bohr, 100 years ago, was due to J.J. Thomson, who discovered the electron. And it was known as the plum pudding model.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like a sphere with a continuous positive charge with Thomson's negatively charged electrons embedded in it. And that was the model that people were thinking of until Bohr came along.
Right. And the concept of orbitals had not been suggested at that point either.
That's right. But a crucial development was the work of Rutherford, who Bohr did work with. And Rutherford did experiments that showed or suggested that, in fact, the atom would have a very small nucleus with an electron attached to the nucleus. And that was a kind of clue for Bohr's model of the hydrogen atom.
So most of us are familiar with Bohr's model of the atom. It does feature the electrons in discrete orbitals instead of just a cloud around a nucleus. But this wasn't all that was radical about Bohr's atomic model. Tell me about, you know, just what this consisted of.
Well, it's quite strange now, but people at the time just didn't realize that the electrons in the hydrogen atom had energy levels, particular energy states.
Mm-hmm.
And what Bohr did was he brought together the idea of Max Planck, who had proposed that energy could be quantized, and Rutherford's model of the atom. He brought together the work of those two great scientists and showed that if you brought their ideas together, you could explain the spectra of the hydrogen atom. That was his big breakthrough.
So how was this breakthrough accepted at the time?
Well, it was quite radical. People just hadn't realized you could bring these two ideas together. But what Bohr managed to do was, after explaining the spectrum of the hydrogen atom, he also showed you could explain the spectrum of the helium plus ion, which had also been measured and not understood. And that then gave some vindication to his theory. And then other people measured more lines in the spectrum of the hydrogen atom a bit later on, for example, in the infrared region, and showed that Bohr's theory fitted that perfectly. So over the few years after 1913, people did begin to accept Bohr's theory.
And then mathematically, his theory also encompassed a new way to define the Rydberg constant as well, right?
Yeah, that was a really important breakthrough. Before Bohr, first from Balmer and then from Rydberg, they had shown that you could fit the lines in the spectrum of the hydrogen atom with a very simple formula that depended just on an empirical constant called, after Rydberg, the Rydberg constant. And Bohr used his theory to express that Rydberg constant in terms of other fundamental constants, just the mass and charge of the electron, and most crucially, Planck's constant.
Mm-hmm.
And it was that that actually caught the eye of the top people like Einstein. They just didn't realize that that Rydberg constant could be expressed in terms of other fundamental constants. That, in some ways, was a big breakthrough due to Bohr.
Now, it's really amazing, you know, all the names that you've said already in this interview. You know, Bohr's work followed directly in the footsteps of Max Planck and J.J. Thomson. He was a contemporary, more or less, of Einstein and also of Rutherford. I mean, what a fantastic time for physics.
That was the great time for physics. It was a true revolution in understanding atoms and matter. And all those great names were involved in discussing things and arguing things in that period.
So Bohr's pioneering paper on the atomic model was really just the first in a trilogy. What did the second and the third papers consist of?
His great paper was his first paper on the hydrogen atom. But then there were two other papers. The second paper was on the electronic structure of other atoms, more complicated than hydrogen. And the third was on molecules, the structure of molecules. And he had the tantalizing idea that there should be a theory that not only explains the hydrogen atom, but more complicated atoms and molecules as well. But it has to be said that the second and third papers weren't so successful. He had a trouble explaining the spectra of more complicated atoms. His theory just wasn't sophisticated enough for that. And then when he went on to molecules, he even got the structure of some molecules wrong. So his second and third paper didn't have the big impact compared to the first.
And some of those molecules include water, right? That he got the structure of the water molecule wrong?
Yeah, his theory gave the water molecule as linear. And everybody knows now that it's not linear. So it was hard for the chemist to really get very keen on Bohr's theory because of that.
Mm-hmm. So his first of these three papers is really the only one that's stood the test of time.
It's the only one that stood the test of time, except the other papers did introduce some new ideas that perhaps you could calculate the magnetic properties of atoms and molecules using a theory. Perhaps you could explain radioactivity using an atomic theory. And those were important ideas that were, of course, taken up later.
So how far have we come in the 100 years since Bohr's atomic theory? What else has this allowed physicists to achieve?
It's really enabled there to be a revolution in physics and in chemistry and in the production of modern devices. I mean, there wouldn't be any lasers, semiconductors, and the devices that follow from that, like computers and mobile phones, without the revolutionary ideal of Niels Bohr. His tantalizing idea was that there would be a theory that could explain all the properties of atoms and molecules in a very useful and accurate way. And although his idea was substantially modified a few years later by people like Schrödinger, the basic idea that there is a theory that explains the atoms and molecules' properties was there and due to Bohr. Nowadays, people solve Schrödinger's equation, and that gives you the energy levels that he predicted of atoms and molecules. Mm-hmm. And it does that for complicated systems like biological molecules, like proteins, or nanomaterials like graphene. And this is a huge area now of being able to explain the properties of matter using the ideas of quantum mechanics that can be traced back to Bohr's ideas.
Wonderful. Well, David Clary, thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much.
David Clary writes about the 100th anniversary of Niels Bohr's atomic theory on Science Express this week. You can read his perspective at www.scienceexpress.org.
In a policy podcast this week, Janet Rowley speaks with Meghna Sachdev about her 40-year-old discovery of chromosomal translocation in leukemia patients, a finding that ultimately revealed cancer as a genetic disease. Here's an excerpt from their interview.
Did I have any idea that that was going to happen when I showed the translocation? Not at all. Different pathways of scientific inquiry came together to give an absolutely marvelous answer.
You can listen to the whole interview, read Janet Rowley's perspective, and find a related book review at www.sciencemag.org.
However you measure it, the United States harbors some of the world's top research universities, in many ways thanks to generous support from the government over the last century. But as federal and state funds get trimmed, the country's research institutions may find themselves turning to philanthropy to survive. Deputy News Editor Jeff Mervis spoke with me about the fate of U.S. research, the final installment in a 6-part news series on global research universities.
Well, we've run 6 stories on a creature that we've called global research universities. And what that is basically the large academic research-oriented universities around the world. And we wanted to look at what are the factors that allow them to thrive, how do you create them, how do they persist, and what is the ebb and flow of those institutions over the decades and indeed the centuries. So we did previous stories that looked at factors that contribute to high-quality academic research like mobility, like collaboration, like commercialization. And we did one on the new university in Saudi Arabia. And this final one is addressing the question of, can the U.S. maintain its preeminence in academic research?
Okay, so this final story comes back to the United States. So tell me, how did the U.S. obtain, how did we reach our scientific preeminence that we have today?
First, I should say, there is a consensus that the U.S. is the preeminent scientific power. There are various academic rankings, which not everyone trusts or believes, but I think, again, there's a general agreement that the U.S. has, and you can pick a number, 18 of the top 25 universities or 34 of the top 50. But it hasn't always been that way. And historians of science point out that you can go back to the Middle Ages in Italy, which was the first universities, and then look to England, look to Germany, and then only in the post-war, World War II era, do U.S. universities really, as a whole, become the clear dominant factor in academic research.
And what drove our rise?
Well, there's a lot of factors that don't have to do with science. They have to do with general economic power, political power, plus talent. But people also say that the U.S. adopted a philosophy after the war that basic research was really a key to economic development and that it was going to be done broadly. It was going to be based on a peer-reviewed system in which every institution had an equal opportunity to build up its expertise, and that created a virtuous cycle where universities would attract talent, that talent would apply for and receive grants, the federal government would continue to support them, universities would put in money for more facilities, and the quality was maintained.
And so what's threatening the prestige of U.S. research institutions today?
Well, there's a couple of factors. One is the question of whether that federal funding will continue. Mm-hmm. And certainly in the last year with the sequester, there's been a lot of concern. But more broadly, declining support by states for their large flagship universities, Michigan's University of Washington, the California universities, Texas universities, and so on. The percentage of money they get from the states has declined precipitously. That hasn't affected the private universities as much. And then you also have competition from the rest of the world. The rest of the world has realized that basic research can be a driver for economic development. Countries are putting lots of money into strengthening their system of higher education, and it's become a global competition for talent.
And so in talking about government funding here in the U.S. in particular, as that winds down, as that decreases, philanthropy and private donations may need to come in and fill that gap. What's the history of philanthropy in university education in the U.S.?
Right. Well, before I answer that, I should say that federal support hasn't declined, but it hasn't kept up with demand.
Right.
And it hasn't kept up with the cost of doing research, and it hasn't kept up with the opportunities to do more research. So it's a system that depends on growth. Specifically with philanthropy, academic philanthropy goes back to the mid-19th century, the so-called robber barons that took their money and invested it in some kind of institution of higher education, whether this was at Johns Hopkins, whose name comes from a wealthy businessman, or whether it was industrialists, Vanderbilt, Stanford, and so on. Those names are on those institutions because those were the benefactors. So there's always been a tradition, but in recent decades, it has expanded well beyond the private universities. So now the public universities have also recognized the importance of having a multi-billion dollar endowment and have started to build up such a pot of money.
Can you give a few more recent examples of philanthropy in U.S. research?
Sure. Well, the largest single benefactor currently is New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, who made his fortune in media. And he has given, as of this year, $1.1 billion to Johns Hopkins And that's reflected not just in structures named after him, but ongoing support for faculty, for student scholarships, and for lots of other things that are essential to the research enterprise. At the same time, capital campaigns that universities conduct used to be one-shot affairs. A university would announce a goal of X amount of money over Y years.
Mm-hmm.
That's become pretty much an ongoing annual campaign. And a good example of that is at Stanford, which completed a campaign several years ago, has continued to raise $1 billion a year.
So a lot of private donors are stepping up to the challenge of supporting science in the U.S., but what will happen if private funding just can't keep up with the growth that universities need?
Well, that is, of course, the big question for university administrators as well as for development officers. Most of them are optimistic that they will continue. The stock market has come back. There is an enormous amount of wealth. And now that the baby boom generation is moving to retirement, the idea is that they will be looking for ways to put that wealth into long-term sustainable societal benefits. Of course, there is concern that even if you can sustain it at a level, the system is based on growth.
Mm-hmm.
And the federal government is still the only institution with deep enough pockets to support the entire university system. So there is a lot of concern that the United States may be moving to a system where you have 20 or 25 truly elite research universities, but the 50, 100, or 200 universities that are trying to be research intensive won't be able to keep up. And then the question is, can the system as a whole continue to be preeminent if you only have a relatively small number of universities that are at the top?
So looking at the big picture of science and technology and innovation around the world, how bad is it for preeminence to move to gain ground in other countries around the world?
Well, that's a really important question, because most university officials will say the more the merrier. You know, a rising tide lifts all boats, fill in whatever cliche you want to use. But the point being is that the more knowledge that's generated around the world, the bigger payoff to society. And in any area, cancer research, information technology, nanotechnology, climate research, the more we know, the better off the world will be, and that there don't have to be national winners and losers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's certainly true. The question, of course, is that national political leaders still want their country to be preeminent, to be number one, or to be rising in whatever international ranking you choose to use.
Mm-hmm.
And so there will always be pressure from politicians who say, is another country catching up to us? U.S. politicians have to ask that question all the time of U.S. scientific leaders. So looking ahead, the question is, can the U.S. maintain the quality that it needs in order for its economy to grow? And can it keep up with the growth in the rest of the world, which is certainly happening?
Right. Well, Jeff Mervis, thanks so much.
Well, thank you.
Jeff Mervis writes about the fate of U.S. research institutions in a News Focus this week. You can read his story and more installments from the series on global research universities at www.sciencemag.org/extra/global.
Finally today, David Grimm, online news editor for Science, is here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site. I'm Sarah Crespi. So, Dave, first up, we have a story on behavior in crowds. Is applauding after a performance or a talk mob behavior? Do we do it just to show appreciation, or are we just trying to fit in?
Well, it turns out there's an element of peer pressure to applause, and just because people are applauding doesn't always mean that the talk or the presentation or the performance was very good. This study has to do with a group of students that were filmed by researchers, at the University of Leeds. And these students were watching a variety of oral presentations, some by undergraduates, some by postgraduates. The researchers took the video of the presentation and the audience response back to the lab, and then they did some pretty heavy analysis of what they saw.
So how much of the clapping that we do is actually due to peer pressure?
Well, it turns out quite a bit of it. Obviously, some people are going to start clapping right away, but it turns out that a lot of the other people in the audience are waiting to hear what everybody else is doing. And what the researchers found is if about 50% of the audience was clapping, individuals were 10 times more likely to start clapping than if only about 5% of the audience was clapping. Mm-hmm. And the same held true for why people stop clapping. People are actually waiting for others to stop clapping before they stop clapping themselves.
I was wondering why we didn't just keep clapping forever.
Right.
So is this the same thing that you would see for booing?
Well, so it's a little bit different from booing. Booing is what's known as more of a high-risk activity. Mm-hmm. That's why you don't hear booing a whole lot. With booing, there tends to be more of a tipping point. So a certain number of people have to start booing before you see this massive amount joining in, whereas with the clapping, there's not this threshold that a certain number of people have to be clapping before others start clapping in large numbers. It's sort of more of an impact on the individual person. And with clapping, you don't really see this large surge once you hit this tipping point like you see with booing.
Okay. Well, is there any relationship between how much clapping or how much booing even and how the performance was?
Well, that was one of the really surprising things the researchers found, was that the applause for a bad presentation could be just as long as the applause for a good one. They found that it was really had to do with these sort of interactions among the audience, and sometimes very random interactions, that determined how long the applause went on.
So that's it for the applause meter.
Right. So, you know, the next time you hear a lot of applause and you don't think it was that great of a performance, you may not just be being a snob. There may actually be something else going on.
Next up, we have a story on inbreeding amongst the first farming families. 10,000 years ago, humans were making the switch from hunters to farmers, and there may be some odd consequences to that change.
There may be indeed, Sarah. It turns out, or at least according to this new study, that some of these early communities, or especially this one community that researchers have studied in a region known as Basta, which is in southern Jordan, it seems that a lot of the people that lived in this village were actually breeding with relatives.
One thing I noticed about this was they didn't look at DNA. They looked at bone structure. Why make that choice?
Well, DNA is actually pretty hard to recover, especially from this population. This is a region where you would have very high temperatures. People were burying their dead under the floors of houses or in shallow graves. All these things degrade genetic material. So if you're looking for evidence of inbreeding, you really have to look beyond the DNA. And what the researchers looked at here were skeletal abnormalities, which has been seen in other populations where there's heavy inbreeding.
So what they noticed about this population that linked them all together was missing teeth. How can that be a genetic abnormality?
It's a bit more complicated than missing teeth. The skulls were indeed missing teeth. They actually were missing the outer incisors on both sides of their upper jaw. This is actually relates to a rare genetic anomaly known as bilateral maxillary lateral incisor agenesis, or let's just call it MLIA, like the researchers do to be a little simpler. This is something that's seen frequently in populations where you have a lot of inbreeding. And it turns out 36% of the skeletons they analyzed had this condition, which is really high. In the general population, there's only incidence of about 4%.
So they are missing the same kind of teeth. So is this something that Neolithic farmers were forced to do? You know, did they have to just rely on each other to keep their population going?
Well, that was one of the ideas. You know, maybe this was a very isolated population and everybody just sort of had to mate with everybody else because that's the only people that were available. But that's actually not what the researchers found. They say this was a population that had nearby populations that they could have mated with, that they traded extensively with other people at the time. So they think it may have been something to do with group solidarity, perhaps mating with one's own family sort of enforced the solidarity of the village, especially when you had these other villages around. Maybe you want to do something to sort of keep those family ties close. And one way to do that would be to keep people mating with other members of the family rather than having them mate with outsiders. Now, that's only a hypothesis. The researchers say they're going to need some sort of DNA evidence to get more proof of that, and that's going to be a challenge.
Finally, we have a story on an amazing property of the naked mole rat, besides their nudity. Naked mole rats have a lot of unique characteristics. For example, they're eusocial, meaning they live in a colony like bees or ants. What other surprises do they have in store for us?
They're also blind, and they're, if I have to say it, pretty ugly.
Yeah.
You can actually take a look at one of them on the site if you dare. They are not the most attractive creatures in the world. But one of the most amazing and unique things about the naked mole rat is actually that they don't get cancer. These are rodents that can live more than 30 years, which is a long time for such a small animal. And researchers have not found a case where they actually naturally get cancer.
So in this study, they have some clues about that, but how do you go about just trying to figure out why something doesn't get cancer?
It's a good question. What the researchers did here was they actually took cells from the mole rats and they put them in a dish in the lab and they started noticing some really strange things about them. The first thing was that the cells didn't really clump up or didn't really get that close together, which is something you see with a lot of other animal cells. You put them in a dish, they sort of form these colonies where they all sort of clump up close to each other. They weren't seeing that with the naked mole rats. Also, the contents of the dish got really gooey over time. And when the researchers analyzed the glue, they found that it contained a complex sugar known as hyaluronan.
So what does this sugar do in the animal normally?
Well, the sugar is released into the extracellular matrix. This is the space between cells. And it's not unique to naked mole rats. Humans and mice and rats also produce this sugar. But what's different about the mole rat version is it's about 5 times the size of the molecules that are seen in those other animals. And the mole rats have an enzyme that breaks down the sugar, but it's not very active in them. It's much more active in some of these other animals. So the researchers think there's something about this sugar that somehow lubricates the spaces between cells. Hyaluronan has actually been used in skin lotions and arthritis treatments, so we already know it has some sort of lubricating properties. And the researchers suspect that the version in mole rats is actually developed over evolutionary time to make their skin more elastic. And that's important for these creatures because they've got to squeeze very tightly into these narrow underground tunnels. But the side effect might be by keeping their cells farther apart, it prevents them from clumping together, which is something that happens when you form tumors, which could explain why these animals don't seem to get cancer.
So they know they have an excess of it. So it might be something that is linked to cancer. How do they actually test that relationship?
Well, that hasn't been done yet. One thing they're thinking about doing is actually putting the naked mole rat version of the sugar into mice, which we know get cancer, and we know we can make cancer in mice, and see if it prevents cancer in mice. And if so, you know, there's always the possibility that it could develop into a treatment for humans.
So what else is on the site this week, Dave?
Well, Sarah, for Science Now, we've got a story about how that grocery store cabbage is more alive than you think. Also a story about how snail trails are shedding light on ancient human migrations. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got an item about how NASA is asking for help capturing asteroids. Also a story about which country now has the most powerful supercomputer. Finally, for Science Live, this week's chat is on the science of superheroes and other Hollywood movies. What does Hollywood get right and wrong when it comes to science? And next week's Science Live is about human cloning. What are the pros, the cons, and the controversy? So check out all these stories on the site.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the editor for Science's online daily news site. You can check out the latest stories and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
Hey, everybody. Carrie Klein here. I just want to let you know that this is my last show as host of the Science Podcast. I've done some really amazing interviews over the past 2 years. I've done Water on Mars, Water on Mercury, journeyed to the center of the Earth, talked about cloud formation, tackled science education and flu epidemics. We've looked inside the lives of ants, talked about African fairy circles and locusts in China, and the list goes on. So thank you so much for listening, and I know that I'll be following along as the show continues. With that, we conclude the June 21st, 2013 edition of the Science Podcast.
Thank you so much, Carrie. You will be missed. And listeners, if you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.